This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the February 1987 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is The Children of the Sea by Patricia Matthews. July 1st, 1889. The cliffs of Crata are tall and gray. Like fortress walls, they protect the island from the sea, which gnaws and frets at their base, opening its fury in sprays of foam. Atop the cliffs, Glendon House perches like some great gray and white bird, its stone and wood seemingly grown from the cliff. I loved it at first sight. My sister Roseanne, of course, hated it. It was, she said, cold and windy and isolated, no fit place for civilized people. And she was, she declared, going to be miserable there. We came to Crata because of my father's health, which had necessitated his leaving his post at the university. Glendon belonged to father's cousin, Cedric Glendon. And since cousin Cedric does not care for the island life and seldom visits Glendon, he offered the use of it to us. As I said, I was delighted with the move. I am, I confess, given to solitary pleasures. I read a great deal, I paint, and I write. I am not much given to the company of large crowds of people, and indeed, I know little of how to make myself agreeable in company. Father says that I need to get out and about more, but mother tells him that I am bookish by nature, like her father, and that he should not push me. If this is true, that I am like her father, then it is the only way in which I am like any member of my family, even one who is dead and gone. Sometimes I have wondered if I am not adopted, or a changeling, perhaps, one of those strange, dark children left on human doorsteps by the elves or goblins. My father is tall, broad-shouldered and ruddy, with fair hair and light hazel eyes. My mother is brown-haired, blue-eyed, and slender. Roseanne inherited the best parts of both, for she is tall, slender, golden-haired, and blue-eyed, with aristocratic features and the assurance that comes with beauty. I, on the other hand, am short, sturdy, dark-haired, and dark-eyed, with a snubbed nose and a short chin. Mother says that I have beautiful eyes, and they are large, but it seems to me that they are far too much so. If Roseanne looks like a goddess, then I look like some little animal, brown and small and sleek. I spent those early days on the island happily, walking along the cliffs, taking the trails that led down to the sand and the rocks, searching the tide pools and reading in the shade of the huge boulders. I painted seascapes, wrote poetry, and began a novel. Father seemed to be enjoying the quiet and was slowly regaining his strength. There was a housekeeper hired from the village who took care of most of the heavy housework, and Mother seemed to be content to tend to the light chores and to sit with Father, reading to him or doing her needlework. It was a peaceful life and pleasant. And then it all changed, for we met Conrack. It was going on for winter then. The seas were growing even wilder and rougher, turning from a brilliant blue to a threatening gray. The blue skies and white clouds of summer were turning also, and often in the afternoon, a fierce wind would rise, moaning through the low, wind-bent trees and whistling through the sea grasses to come tearing at the house with cold fingers. Father, although he was growing stronger, was still not able to do all the things that needed to be done before the winter set in. Storm windows needed to be put up, wood laid in for the fire, such things as that. It was Mrs. Llewellyn, the housekeeper, who suggested Conrack. "He's a good lad," she said to Father. I was listening from my chair near the fire in the drawing room. "And strong and willing. His mother, Mrs. Moore, is a widow, and they need the money. I am sure that you will find him satisfactory." Mrs. Llewellyn gave my father directions to the widow's house in the village, and Father said that he would go and see the boy that very afternoon. Roseanne, who had been fidgeting about the room, asked if she might go with him. I was surprised, I admit, for Roseanne usually had only harsh things to say about the small village down by the bay. The villagers were an ignorant lot, she said, and the village itself smelled of fish, as well it might, for it was a fishing village after all. Father asked me if I would like to go as well, but I was at an interesting point in the novel I was reading, and so it was that Roseanne met Conrack before I did. When she and Father returned for dinner, her cheeks were pink and her eyes were bright. I could not help but notice, and Mother, too, looked at her curiously. "Well, Roseanne," Mother said, "you seem to have brightened considerably. What was there at that village, which you usually find so dull, to put such a glow on your cheeks?" "Oh, Mother," answered Roseanne, turning pinker still, "it was just the wind, just getting out of the house." Mother smiled, for she knew Roseanne as well as I did, and turned to Father. "What is the boy like? Do you think he will do?" Father helped himself to another piece of roast and nodded. "He's a strapping lad, much taller and better made than most of the villagers I've seen. Quite attractive in a rough way, and seemingly bright and willing." Mother nodded. "Good. I'm pleased that in hiring him we will be helping the villagers in a small way. They seem to work so hard and yet have so little, and I have always found them gentle and friendly." This with a reproving glance at Roseanne. Father shook his head. "I shouldn't rely on their gentleness or their friendliness too much, my dear. Although they appear to be a quiet, well-behaved people, they have some strange ways. I have heard, for instance, that if someone, even one of their own, commits a wrong or harms the village or one of its people, the villagers exact a severe punishment. 3 days passed before I met Conrack, and when I did, I was no longer surprised that Roseanne had shown an interest in one of the villagers. Father's description had been modest. Conrack was all that he had said and more. Although he had the dark hair and skin of the other villagers, he was far taller than most, and so his heavy shoulders and sturdy build were shown in a more favorable aspect. However, it was his face that one noticed most, for although somewhat rough-hewn, it was very handsome, and his eyes, very large and black, seemed to glow with intelligence and understanding. I came upon him at the rear of the house where I had gone to retrieve some clothing that Mother had hung on the line to dry. He was chopping wood, the sleeves of his rough blue shirt rolled up above his muscular forearms, and the neck of the shirt open to show the strong brown column of his throat. He stopped his work when he caught sight of me and smiled, showing perfect, even white teeth. "Hello," he said in a deep voice. "You must be the other one, Mercy." Somehow, his manner precluded any offense that might have been inherent in the words themselves. I found myself returning his smile. "Yes, I am the other one," I said, "and you must be Conrack." He nodded and leaned upon the axe handle. "It's a pleasure to meet you," he said. "I was beginning to think that you did not exist, although your father told me that he had 2 daughters. "Well, I'm the quiet one," I explained. "Roseanne is the kind of girl that people notice, all bright and shining. I'm like a shadow, small and dark, and who notices a shadow?" He laughed, throwing back his head. "Another shadow," he said at last. "Almost all of the islanders are small and dark. A few are tall and dark, like me. Besides, your sister may shine on the surface, but what is underneath? You shine from the inside out, and that is the kind of shine that lasts. As he said this, he looked deep inside my eyes, and I felt my heart lurch, just as they say in novels, and I grew faint. Something that I did not usually permit myself to feel began to rise in me. Was it possible that I had finally met a boy, a man, who would prefer me to Roseanne? As the days progressed, marching towards winter with chilly certainty, we became friends, good friends, and, despite my hesitations and fears, more than friends. For the first time, I began to know what it might be like to love a man. Roseanne, at first too bound up in herself to notice anything or anyone else, finally began to become aware that Conrack was spending a great deal of his time with me, and for the first time in our existence, Roseanne became jealous of me. At first, I think, she could not believe that someone, a man, would prefer my company to hers. She continually made excuses to be where Conrack was working, and she flirted with him shamelessly. When she began her campaign, for a campaign it was, I was again beset by doubt, certain that she was right, that no man in his right mind could resist her. But as time went on, I could see that what Conrack had told me was true. He did not find Roseanne attractive. He was put off by her vanity and superficiality, and I began to accept the fact that he cared for me, for he told me so with words, glances, and touches, until I finally felt loved and dared to love in return. How can I describe the wonder of it, the glory, the thrill that ran through me when he touched me, when we kissed? Sometimes we would sit on the rocks overlooking the sea, and he would tell me stories of the island, of the village and its people. They were fisher folk, he said, and had been for as long as people had lived on the island. A strange people, he admitted, with many stories and legends, but generally kind and peace-loving, with a great feeling for their island and for the sea. His mother belonged to one of the oldest families on the island, but he knew little of his father, who had disappeared at sea when Conrack was but a small boy. As we talked, we would watch the sea, the soaring gulls and the seals cavorting below like clowns, barking and diving, their intelligent, whiskered faces rising from the water, round and sleek. I thought they were beautiful and said so. And Conrack smiled. "Do you know what we call them?" he asked. "We call them the children of the sea." I squeezed his strong hand, which was holding mine, in its warm grasp. "It seems a reasonable name to me," I said. "They seem far more civilized than some humans I have known." He laughed and pulled me to him and kissed me upon the brow. "My wise Mercy," he said, "you see so clearly, and that is one of the reasons why I love you." I felt so good, so at peace and happy. It was a rude shock to hear Roseanne's voice behind us, stiff and cold with anger. "Well," she said loudly, "I wonder what Father will say when I tell him about this, Mercy." Conrack and I both turned, startled, out of our warm mood. Roseanne's face was pale, except for her cheeks, which burned red. I could not understand the reason for her great anger. Surely she did not need the admiration of every man in the world. Surely she could spare me one, this one. Roseanne turned and began to run back towards the house. Conrack stood and took me in his arms, holding me fiercely close. His face had grown dark and set. "I think that whatever she does will not be good," he said slowly. "She is an evil person, Mercy. Evil, because in her vain and shallow preoccupation with herself, she cares for no one else." I felt tears welling up in my throat and the heavy weight of apprehension in my chest, for I knew he was right. "I'd best go after her," I said, beginning to pull away, but he drew me close again. "Not yet," he said. I must tell you something first, something important to both of us. And so it was not until a good half hour later that I returned to the house and found out what my sister had told my parents. At first I could not believe it. Even Roseanne, selfish and thoughtless as she was, could not be that wicked and cruel. She sat on the blue sofa, her head forward so that her hair covered her face, and well she might hide, I thought, after telling such a cruel lie. The bodice of her dress, which had been whole when she had run away from us on the cliff, was torn away from her shoulders and chest. Mother was distraught and pale, and Father was flushed with anger and indignation. He was, I could tell, all set to defend his daughter's honor, although she had none. Mother, Father, she is lying, I cried finally after they had told me the story. Conrack has no feelings towards Roseanne, except impatience that she keeps bothering him. Roseanne kept her face hidden, but Mother and Father both looked at me pityingly, as if they thought me too naive and inexperienced to judge such a matter, for it was inconceivable to both of them that any man or boy would not desire Roseanne. I let my anger take me. They were so blind. It is the truth, I said loudly. Roseanne has thrown herself at Conrack, but he cares nothing for her. It is me he loves, and she cannot stand it. That is why she lies. Father and mother both looked slowly at Roseanne and then back at me. I could see from their expressions that whatever I might say would be of no use. They were too used to thinking of Roseanne and me in certain ways, and they could not change this pattern now. Roseanne, I cried pleadingly, tell them the truth. But she looked up at me defiantly, and I could see the anger and determination in her eyes. It is the truth, she said coldly. What reason would I have to lie? And that, of course, settled it, for in my parents' eyes there could be no reason except that it had happened. Conrack had assaulted their beautiful daughter, had attempted to rape her, but she managed to escape him and flee to the house. It was growing dark, and I could hear the wind building a storm outside of Glendon House's thick walls. The growing darkness added to my fear and apprehension. My father was usually a reasonable man, but like the people he had spoken of in the village, he flared into protective anger when someone or something of his was threatened, and once his anger was aroused and he had made up his mind to a course of action, he could not be dissuaded. I am going down to the village, he announced. That young man will be brought up on charges. Mother, her face white, touched his sleeve. But Warren, it is growing dark. There's a storm coming, and the villagers. You said yourself that they do not take kindly to interference. Surely it can wait until morning. Father glared at her. By tomorrow morning he could be well away from the island or hidden from us. I must go now and bring him back here. In the morning I will send for the authorities on the mainland. But what if the villagers, do not believe you? What if they will not let you take him? Father's face creased in a humorless grin as he opened his gun cabinet and pulled forth an evil-looking pistol. This will help me convince them of the justice of my act. I could not suppress a moan of dismay, and even Roseanne seemed to be nonplussed by what she had set in motion. Father turned and stalked towards the entryway, and I turned to Mother. Whatever you may think, I cried, Roseanne is lying. I am going after Father, and it will do you no good to try to stop me. Mother's face was still pale, but her lips were set. We will all go. No matter what happened, I do not want your father ruining all of our lives by some rash act committed in anger. Get your coat, Roseanne. I will get a lantern. Roseanne's eyes showed panic, but she began to do as she was told. Not waiting for Mother and the lantern, I ran to the entryway and pulled a heavy shawl from its hook and was out the door. Against the lowering sky, I could see Father's figure as he began to make his way down the easier of the two paths that led to the village below. My fear made me feel strong and reckless. I ran to the second path, which is much steeper and rockier than the path Father was taking, but also much shorter. My only thought was to reach the village first, so that I might warn Conrak. The wind was growing in strength, and the sea-damp air penetrated my shawl, adding to the chill that I felt inside. Down and down I went, my purpose lending keenness to my sight and strength to my limbs, until at last I reached the village. I had never been to the Moore house, but I remembered the directions that Mrs. Llewellyn had given to my father and made my way to the low, simple cottage that clung to a level space above a jumble of huge rocks that stood between it and the roughening sea. There, I pounded wildly upon the heavy wooden door. A short, plump woman with threads of white in her dark hair answered my knock, and without shame or courtesy, I thrust myself into the room, pushing the door closed behind me. "Conrak," I gasped. "I must see Conrak." She lifted the lantern she was holding and looked at me for what seemed a long moment, and then she smiled. "You must be Mercy, then." "No time," I said. "Conrak, my sister has done something terrible. My father is coming to get Conrak. There is no time to explain." Mrs. Moore put her hand upon my arm, and her expression was very calm. Was it possible that she did not realize the seriousness of what I had just said? And then Conrak came into the room. His expression, too, was calm, and he looked at me with love and tenderness. "It will be all right, Mercy," he had said softly. "No matter what appears to happen tonight, remember that I love you, and remember what I told you this afternoon upon the cliffs." He had no time to say more, for there was a great pounding at the door, and my father's voice crying out Conrak's name. I clung to Conrak and tried to keep him from opening the door, but it was no use. He opened the door and faced my father calmly, as water faces the fire. I was beside myself with fear. Behind my father, I could see the pale faces of my mother and sister, and in that moment, I hated Roseanne as I have never hated anyone before or since. My father was shouting something, but the wind caught his words and tore them away before my ears could hear them. My father moved back, away from the door, and Conrak moved towards him, leaving the house. I reached towards Conrak, but his mother, very gently but with great strength, pulled me back as Conrak moved out into the night. They stood now, clear of the house, on the edge of the rocks as the wind buffeted and tore at their clothing. I could see that Father was shouting and that Conrak was answering, but I could hear nothing as I strained against Mrs. Moore's strong hands. Mother and Roseanne stood a bit to one side, huddled away from the sting of the salt spray that the wind was now flinging at the cottage. And then I saw Father take out the gun and begin to wave it wildly. At that moment, the moon shone briefly between the scudding clouds, and I clearly saw Conrak's face, set and implacable in the cold night. I am still to this day not certain of just what happened in the moment that followed. I know only that Conrak moved very quickly, so quickly it seemed he had not moved at all, and yet there he stood, on the edge of the rocks with Roseanne in the bend of his arm. The next moment they were both gone, and only my mother's agonized scream rose above the roar of the wind and the sea. Just as quickly as that, it was over. Just as quickly as that were our lives changed forever. There was nothing to be done, of course. Roseanne's body was found the next day, washed up on the beach below Glendon House, but although the authorities from the mainland came and searched the beaches and coves, no trace of Conrack's body was found. But could he still be alive? My father asked with red eyes and ragged voice, although I cannot find it in my heart to mourn for my sister. I feel very sorry for my parents, for I know what pain they are suffering. They feel they are alone now, for Roseanne was their golden child and she is gone. And me? Oh, they love me in a certain fashion, and they will protest when I tell them that I do not intend to go with them back to England, but they spent so much of their love on Roseanne that they never let me get close enough that they might take comfort from me. So the fact that I will be staying behind will not hurt them unduly. Besides, I am of age, and they cannot prevent me from following my own course. I am remaining on Craddock. I have already sent a wire to Cousin Cedric asking if I may continue to stay at Glendon House as caretaker, and since he does not like to leave the place unoccupied, I am certain he will agree. My parents will be leaving in a week or so, and when they are gone, my real life will begin. My life with Conrack, for he is becoming back, you know. I am as certain of it as I am of life itself, for I remember one of the things he told me that day on the cliffs. Water, no matter how rough and violent, can never be the death of one of the children of the sea. We continue with a story from the March 1987 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Game of Magical Death by Doug Hornig. I don't want to eat my salad, Billy Sampson said. I don't like salad. Besides, I've got a lot to do. May I be excused, please? His parents were so out of it. They didn't know a CPU from a BMW. It was useless talking to them. In the electronic age, they were dinosaurs. Billy, his mother said, we don't care what kind of fancy computer program you have to write tonight. If you don't get enough vitamins, you won't be able to write your own name. Now eat. He pushed the salad around his plate, a bunch of soggy vegetables. There was no point in attempting to explain that when you were the first kid to get a new game, you had to try it out right away, that there were matters of status involved, not to mention the excitement of the unknown. The only thing to do was humor them. Somehow he got down most of the salad, nearly gagging in the process. Now may I be excused, please? Don't you want any dessert, Billy? Maybe later. All right, try to get to bed at a decent hour, will you? Billy went quickly to his room and shut the door. There was one thing his parents were good about. They respected his privacy. If the door was closed, they wouldn't disturb him unless he invited them in. His IBM personal computer sat on the desk, inert, mere potential. It wasn't the best micro on the market. In fact, considering what you got for the money, it was one of the worst. Still, because of the IBM on the nameplate, it was clobbering the competition. More new stuff was being written for its operating system than for any other. That's why he'd traded up and gotten one. Some of his friends in the local hacker network had done the same. Others had decided to hold on to their Apples and CPM machines for a while. That way, the group as a whole covered the field. Carefully, lovingly, he removed the new floppy disk from its protective sleeve. It had come into his possession by pure chance, so he was sure none of the other guys had it yet. He'd been reading Computer World, as he did every week, and had idly glanced at the employment section, something he rarely did. There, he'd found a tiny box ad that someone had presumably placed in that section by mistake. It read, The Game of Magical Death for IBM PC and Compatibles, new From Personal Computer Odysseys, Homer, Alaska, 99603, 5995. Billy Simpson had never heard of Homer, Alaska, much less of Personal Computer Odysseys. That wasn't surprising. The new companies came and went faster than you could keep track of them. Now, here was one with a brand new game. It was a bit pricey, but if he scooped the gang, it'd be worth it. Billy had sent off his check the same afternoon. The game arrived in 5 days. Peculiar. How long did it take the mail to get to Alaska and back anyway? Certainly more than 5 days. And then there was the 3-line printed note that was packed with the floppy. Personal Computer Odysseys. Prompt personalized service, our specialty. Thank you for the anticipated order. Whatever that meant. But Billy didn't like to dwell on things over which he had no control. If it was a strange company, so what? There were a lot of strange people in the field. The thing that mattered was the quality of the product. He slotted MS-DOS into one of the PC's drives and booted up. Then he loaded his new game. "Good day, Mr. Sampson," the screen said. "Do you wish to play the game of magical death? If so, hit return." He knows my name, huh? Now that's personalized service. He pressed the return key. The next screen appeared. Select level of play. Level 1, random death. Level 2, multiple death. Level 3, interpersonal death. Level 4, creator death. Level 5, personal death. Abort. Great. A decent game had to have levels of play. The working assumption was that the lower levels could be too easy for him. Billy excelled at games. He always started at a higher level than anyone else. He was the best, so he entered a 5. Bypass the kid stuff. Access denied. Nervy of it. Oh well. He tried a 4, then a 3, and a 2. Same result in each case. Finally, he settled for a 1. Random death. Your opponent is... There was a 10-second pause before the name Jeffrey Highport appeared. Then, select 3 weapons, followed by a menu of about 2 dozen choices. Billy was going to like this game. There was no accompanying instructional booklet. Therefore, he had no idea of how the weapons had to be used or what his opponent was armed with. This was a neat touch. He'd have to feel his way along, learn by doing. He selected impenetrable umbrella, evasive action, and heat-sensitive laser, 1 offensive weapon, 1 defensive, and 1 that could go either way. A good mix. Opponent has ingested a mind-altering chemical that gives great determination but diminished motor ability. His physical is pursuing at a high rate of speed and will impact you in X seconds. Your response. An elementary trap unworthy of Billy's abilities. The umbrella would be something they'd let him use only once. Otherwise, he could hide behind it indefinitely, and the game would stalemate. If he activated it too early, his opponent would likely just go around it, and his defenses would be seriously compromised. The trick would be to set the umbrella at a time when the pursuing vehicle's momentum would carry it to destruction. For now, just slow it up. He typed heat-sensitive laser, X equals 30, vehicle partially disabled, impact in X seconds, single trajectory missile launched. Your response. So far, so good. 30 seconds would have been plenty of time to avoid the umbrella. He'd scored a hit with the laser, and his opponent's coordination was impaired because of the drug. Assuming they'd started with roughly equal weaponry, it was time to seize the advantage. None. X equals 35. Missile wide of target. Vehicle self-repairing. Impact in X seconds. Your response. Billy had him now. The self-repair feature would have been a defensive weapon. The guy would probably have only one more. It was time to suck him in for the kill. Evasive action. X equals 10. Vehicle igniting afterburner. Impact in X seconds. Your response. Since there was no way of telling whether they were going to operate on clock time, Billy punched in his response immediately. Impenetrable umbrella. X equals 3. Impact. Vehicle destroyed. Opponent neutralized. You win, Billy Sampson. And then the screen went blank. No return to the original menu. No further instructions. Nothing. Billy tried every technique he could think of, but was unable to coax a response from the machine. He even turned the PC off and started from scratch. Still, nothing. What the hell? That wasn't fair. It was an interesting game, sure, but he hadn't paid $59.95 for something that conked out at level one. By the time he went to bed, Billy had composed in his mind a very nasty letter to the people at Personal Computer Odysseys. The second floppy arrived the following day. It was waiting when he got home from school. So, the game was played on sequential diskettes. Very interesting. Perhaps the last one would reactivate the first so that someone else could play. That would be okay. He put the game away. He'd play it later, build up his anticipation first. After dinner, his father said, "Billy, can I talk to you seriously for a couple of minutes?" "Sure, Dad." Here it came again. How was he wasting his time with that silly computer? How his schoolwork was suffering, etc., etc. He'd learned to let it in one ear and out the other without really listening. They settled themselves in the living room. "Now, son," his father began, "in a couple of months you'll be getting your driver's license. I guess you know what a responsibility that's going to be." "I sure do, Dad." This didn't look so bad after all. "Billy, I don't know if you drink. Do you drink, son?" "I have a beer now and then, you know, with the guys." "Well, thank you for being honest. I don't condemn it, of course. I like the occasional cocktail myself, as you will have observed. But there's one thing I'd like you to promise me." "What's that, Dad?" "Your mother and I have talked it over. We'd like you to promise that after you get your license, if you've ever had one beer too many, you'll call us, and we'll come bring you home. It doesn't matter what time it is, just call before you drive. We'd rather you got us out of bed than take the chance of, well, of something like this." Billy's father handed him the afternoon paper. On the front page was a three-column photo, the crumpled remains of an unidentifiable car. "Such a young fella, too," Billy's father said, "just a year older than yourself. Will you promise us, son?" "Sure, Dad, no problem." He didn't drink that much anyway. "Thank you. We appreciate it." Billy gave the story accompanying the photo a quick scan. "Jeffrey Highport, 17, of Crozet, was killed yesterday evening when he lost control of his vehicle and struck a concrete bridge abutment on Interstate 64. Police said the youth was returning home from a party in Charlottesville at which there had been some drinking, although it was not immediately. Then he stopped and looked again at the name. He stared at it. Jeffrey Highport. Very slowly, he set the newspaper down on the sofa. His mouth was suddenly dry. He ran his tongue over his lips. "What is it, son?" his father asked. "That's a terrible story, Dad. You don't have to worry about that with me. No, not me." Billy got up, went to his room, and closed the door. No, it was a coincidence. It had to be. There was no way. For an hour, he sat on his bed, turning the new floppy disk over and over in his hand, wondering what to do. It was a coincidence. Those kinds of things happened all the time. Guy goes fishing, catches a big bass, opens it up, and there's the wedding ring he dropped in the lake 20 years earlier. It happens. No, it doesn't. Not like this. There was only one explanation. Billy Sampson had somehow caused the death of a local teenager he'd never even met. It was insane, but there it was. Jeffrey was indisputably dead. He thought about it some more, slowly realized that he was wrong. There was another possibility. That was that Jeffrey had always been going to die. He had always been going to be drinking. His car had always been going to crash on that specific day. And what the game had done was to open a window somewhere that gave Billy a fleeting glimpse of the future. In that case, he bore no responsibility, except to try to use what he had discovered for some positive purpose. There was only one thing to do, of course, despite all of the agonizing. Not one person in 1,000 would have done any differently. He booted up the PC and activated the new diskette. "Welcome back, Mr. Sampson. Do you wish to continue the game of magical death?" He hit return. The familiar menu appeared. Billy felt that he now understood the rules, but he tried 1, 3, 4, and 5 anyway. Unsurprisingly, access was denied. The game was consistent. He entered a 2. Multiple death. Your opponents are, pause, Robert Archer, Belinda Archer, Sally Archer, Cookie Archer. Select 4 weapons. The menu was entirely different this round. Billy examined it, searching for a pattern. The first time, he'd selected casually and had won with his play. As he moved to higher levels, the game was apt to be less forgiving. He'd need more than proper timing. Appropriate firepower would be essential. He made his choice. Opponents are barricaded in fortress, preparing poison gas. Gas is irresistible when completed. You have 15 minutes, your response. This time he was expected to make the first move. He thought about it. After 10 minutes, he decided that they'd figure him to be setting up a diversion, so he fired his best shot first. Fire arrow. Opponent failed to raise protective shutters in time. Fortress on fire. Sprinklers activated. Your response. Horse. Opponent attacks with crossbow ineffective. Poison gas explosion before fire extinguished. Fortress destroyed. Your response. That should have been it. The gas had blown up. He was at a safe distance. It ought to be over. What was wrong? Of course, he typed quickly. Armor. Assuming the gas itself wasn't counted, the opponents had used 3 of their 4 weapons, leaving them 1. That wouldn't matter unless there was someone to use it. Surviving Archer's spear neutralized by armor. Your response. Hand axe. All opponents neutralized. You win, Billy Sampson. The screen went blank. This time, Billy didn't attempt to revive it. He went to bed, where he tossed and turned, succumbing to nightmares whenever he drifted off. The third diskette showed up on Saturday. Billy had spent the previous 2 days in bed in his room, dreading its arrival. He'd gone home sick from school the day he'd heard about the Archer family. They had lived in the Belmont section of town. Robert and Belinda and their 2 daughters. Robert worked for the phone company. The night Billy was playing level 2 of the game, the gas main in the Archer's house ruptured. Enough gas eventually accumulated that the stove's pilot light ignited it. 3 members of the family burned to death in their home. The 4th, Sally, was the older sister, and her bedroom was farthest from the site of the explosion. She jumped from her 2nd-story window before the flames got to her. When she landed, she pitched forward and hit her head on a stone. The blow split her skull and killed her. At 7 in the evening, Billy's father came into his room. "Son," he said, "I know how poorly you've been feeling, but do you think you could get along without your mother and me for a couple of hours? There's this darn cocktail party at David's over on High Street, and, well, it's important to the business that we be there. Think you'll be okay?" "Sure, Dad. Thanks, I'll make it up to you." In truth, Billy wasn't unhappy that his parents were going out. He couldn't tell them what was happening. They'd immediately phone the university clinic and make an appointment with the head of psychiatry. Despite being sick with fear, Billy knew that he would proceed to level 3. It was probably best done alone. "We meet again, Mr. Sampson," the screen said this time. "Are you sure you want to continue with the game of magical death?" Billy hesitated, but only for a moment before firmly striking the return key. Then he entered 3. This time there was no pause by the machine. "Interpersonal death. You are defending Mr. and Mrs. William Sampson. Select 2 weapons." Oh, God, they changed the rules on him, and he could make only 2 choices out of 24. The sweat ran off him. Was he in real time, and was the clock running? He couldn't guess. He studied the menu, his brain a maze of rapidly shifting deductive logic circuits. Then he had it. It was simple. This time he had one big advantage. He knew where his parents were. Given that, there weren't but so many possibilities. Or were there? Car wreck? Poison canapes? Act of God? No, he'd stick with his original conclusion. He chose. "Defendants are accosted by gang of street toughs armed with knives. Your response." Piece of cake. The game was forcing him to make the initial response for the second time in a row, but he'd anticipated that as well as the nature of the threat. One weapon was all he really needed. He typed the words without hesitation, black and white. "Street toughs dispersed by police. Cruiser defendants unharmed. You win, Billy Sampson." Blank screen. Billy chucked the diskette into the wastebasket. He was finished being sick, too. He was on top of things now, the best. Half an hour later, he had to endure his parents' recounting of their harrowing experience. He feigned wide-eyed interest and profound relief that they'd come through it all unscathed. That night, he slept like the dead. The 4th diskette came with the next mail. Billy was ready for it. The game was a challenge once again. He raced through dinner, even eating his salad, then hurried to his room. "My son, the computer genius," Billy's father said sarcastically to his mother. "No time for us common folks." But by then, Billy was staring at the latest screen. "Do you wish to engage in the game of magical death, Mr. Sampson?" He hit return, then spent a long time contemplating the level menu. Level 4 was creator death. What did that mean? Surely he wasn't gaming with God, the creator of the game, then? That must be it. The message had said, "Do you wish to engage me?" And what could the outcome be? His own life wouldn't be on the line. Personal death was level 5. If it was the creator's life, what would happen if that were lost? Was it the end of the game? Billy considered typing in abort, but he just wasn't sure what would happen then. It might mean that he'd never be allowed to play again. And in spite of everything, he didn't want the game to end. He punched 4. Creator death, select 6 weapons. That was it. No indication of who was fighting whom for what. The menu was the usual length, but 6 selections meant that some very complex action sequences were possible. Billy chose carefully, hoping to mislead the game as to his intentions. When he finished, the machine typed, "Your response." All right, that was fair. If the creator was indeed fighting for its life, it deserved to be able to maximize its chances. So it was making the first move, but demanding that Billy respond before he knew what that move was. Billy reasoned that in his first move, at the two previous levels, he'd taken his best shot. The game might thus reason that he tried to trick it by doing that a third time. But then it would reason that he knew that and would keep his good stuff in reserve. Finally, at this level of complexity, it would have to assume that Billy would double back once more and end up where he'd started, taking the big step after all. Primary defense would thus be activated at once. So Billy used one of his lesser weapons, airstrike. Aircraft destroyed by heat-seeking missiles. Your response. He'd been wrong. The game had precisely anticipated his first move, using neither more nor less than it needed to counter. It would now attack, thinking that Billy wouldn't expect so logical a move. Landmines. Assault tanks lost in minefield. Your response. They were neck and neck. This was the moment Billy knew. He knew it suddenly and with perfect clarity. He knew that the game was going to make a secondary move of some kind. It was time to blast away. He passed up indestructible shield and typed 10 megaton thermonuclear device. Electromagnetic scattering, insufficient deterrent to thermonuclear bomb. Command headquarters destroyed. You win, Billy Sampson. Thank you for playing the game. Goodbye and good luck. Once again, the blank screen. He'd done it. The story was on the front page of the afternoon paper. An earthquake had rocked Alaska's Kenai Peninsula, a savage one. Homer had been particularly hard hit. Much of it was now rubble. There was no telling how many lives had been lost or what the true extent of property damage was. Billy was stunned. He knew without doubt who one of the casualties was. The creator had been playing for keeps. Yet even more surprising was the arrival of the fifth diskette in the afternoon mail. Billy hadn't expected that. He thought that if the creator lost at level 4, there would never be a level 5. Now he was looking at the level menu. It had come up without an opening message. It was either 5 or abort. There were no other choices left. Personal death. What did that mean? His death? Or the death of some unknown number of persons? How would the battle be fought? If he won, was there a reward? There must be. The stakes were too high to think otherwise. What could be worth his life? The permanent gift of future sight? The screen offered no help. His finger hovered over the keyboard. Life or death? Life and death. Whose? It dropped onto the 5. The message came up. An incurable plague threatens all human life on the planet. No treatment possible. The message faded. Either A or B neutralizes the threat and successfully completes the game. Fade. Either A or B to terminate the game. Your response. A 50-50 chance. No clues. Billy Sampson began to scream. He screamed and screamed and could not stop. He stared at the message and screamed. Billy's father rushed into the room, grabbed Billy around the shoulders, shook him. Son, he said, what is it? What is it? Billy continued to scream. Billy's father looked at the computer screen. Oh, for God's sake, he said, and punched A. Along the Carenage, in the city of St. George's, Grenada,
an island nation occupied by foreign powers, the first child, a girl, age 7, went into convulsions. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader of Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.